Whether it's her first Mother's Day or her 40th, she deserves more. Shop tons of stunning on-trend jewelry for every budget at Diamonds Direct. Diamond fashion jewelry, beautiful birthstones, everyday pearls, starting at just $200. Commemorate the real loves of her life with a gorgeous pendant featuring the birthstone of the one who made her mom. This Mother's Day, Diamonds Direct has everything you need to say thank you. Diamonds Direct, your love, our passion. Online at DiamondsDirect.com.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Hello and happy Saturday. This week's episode on Marjorie Courtney Latimer and the coelacanth kept making me think about one of our previous episodes, and that was the one on the extinction of the Stevens Island wren. These are really very different stories, but they both have islands and extinct animal species and specimen collection and the impact of outdoor cats on an ecosystem.
So it is today's Saturday Classic. This episode originally came out on June 14th, 2017. Enjoy. Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
Hey, Tracy, have you ever heard of a cat named Tibbles who was single-handedly responsible, or pawedly, you'll sometimes see it written out, for wiping out an entire species of bird?
Yep, because of a lighthouse keeper.
Yeah, it shows up on various listicles from time to time. Along the lines, you'll see, like, X animals who changed history. It's one of the most famous extinction stories, and because it has this quaint, though sad, aspect to it, it has really taken on a life of its own, and it's one that gets repeated a lot. But the real story is actually a lot more complex than simply saying one cat killed all the birds. So today we're going to take a look at the original tale as it's usually told, and then we'll delve into the reality of the demise of the bird species involved, because the bird did legitimately go extinct. That part is true. And it also becomes an interesting story of conservation and the importance of protecting both flora and fauna, unique to specific and isolated locations. And there's even a little bit of scientific community intrigue and offense in the mix. So it's got everything for a good story. Also, because this does involve extinction and then later ways to try to combat similar problems, it's pretty much a whole episode where we talk about animals being killed. So if that is something particularly sensitive to you, this might not be your episode. I will say this. I am usually particularly sensitive to it. It does not bother me in this context. So I don't know if that's your guidepost or not, but there you go.
Well, and having had an outdoor cat from like 1980 until approximately 1996, a long time. But anyway, I grew up with an outdoor cat because we lived out in the country and that was what you did.
Yeah, you become accustomed to cats bringing you things.
Yeah, cats bringing us small animals was something that happened all the time. So
yeah, we had that growing up, and it is one of the reasons my small herd never goes outside.
Yeah. Yeah, my cats, once I was an adult and caring for my own cats, were strictly indoor. Although a couple of them did escape on at least one occasion.
Yeah. Yeah, but today we're going to talk about the Stevens Island wren and this cat and what did and did not happen.
The particular wren in this story was a tiny bird. It could fit in the palm of a human hand, and it was found on Stevens Island, which is in New Zealand. It's likely that these wrens, known as Xenicus traversia leali in Latin and sometimes called Lyell wrens, were possibly part of the fauna of ancient Gondwanaland. They were related to the kiwi.
Fossil evidence suggests that these tiny birds are ones that are incredibly closely related to them, once lived throughout New Zealand. And it's believed that the introduction of predatory species such as rats eliminated them from all the other areas of the country but Stephen's Island, which was isolated by the 1890s.
The birds were dark olive brown in color, with yellowish coloring at the throat and the breast. Skeletal evidence, as well as witness accounts, indicate that the wren was flightless. It spent its time on the ground hunting for insects to eat, and that makes it one of only three known flightless songbirds in the world. The wrens nested in small, out-of-the-way spots, such as holes and recesses under rocks, and it was also believed to have been nocturnal.
Yeah, I read one account that said that it weighed about the same as a quarter, but I didn't find anything that backed that up. But even so, it's a very tiny, light little thing. And sometimes you'll see it, when people described it, they talked about it being almost more like a mouse than a bird in some ways, probably because it scurried along the ground. The island itself is also known by its Maori name, Takepuruwa, and it is a small place. It is less than a square mile. That's another one of those things that gets reported very differently. Some will say it's only half a square mile, some even less than that. But we know that it's less than a square mile, about 1.5 square kilometers estimate. And it sits about 2 miles off of New Zealand's South Island's northern shore at the northern edge of the Marlborough Sounds. And the weather on the island is mild in temperatures, but there is frequent rain and often high winds.
It was renamed Stephen's Island after Philip Stephens, the late 18th century first secretary to the Admiralty of the United Kingdom. Prior to the 1870s, it hadn't been explored by any Anglo parties. It's unknown if any Maori peoples visited it prior to that, but it was a pristine place in terms of its ecological condition when maritime officials from New Zealand first visited it.
And because the island sits on a shipping route and there had been several shipwrecks nearby in the middle of the century, it was outfitted with an oil-powered lighthouse in 1894. That lighthouse stood at the highest elevation point above sea level of any lighthouse in New Zealand at the time. It was also more powerful than any others in New Zealand at that time, and it cost more than £9,000 to build.
Before the lighthouse was installed to illuminate the Cook Strait's western approaches, Stephen's Island was almost entirely untouched. There were no non-native species that had been introduced. The flora was just natural and unchecked and undeveloped.
Well into the 1800s, the tiny island was pretty densely forested. When workers first arrived in 1892 to start construction on the lighthouse, birds were abundant. The journals of one of the men, F.W. Ingram, are quoted in a 2004 paper about the extinction of the wren. That paper was written by Ross Galbraith and Derek Brown. And according to Ingram's account, there were two kinds of wren, saddlebacks, native thrush, and native crows on the island when the work began there.
After the lighthouse and a small farm were established, an estimated 90% of the island's native forest was destroyed due to grazing and fire. A patchy low forest eventually established and remains in the place of the thick forest that had been destroyed, and shrubs, grasses, and vinelands persisted also.
So with this new fancy lighthouse, the island needed a lighthouse keeper. So we are getting now into the story as it's usually told. So in 1894, David Lyell moved to Stephen's Island to fill that position. And the island was not easy to get to. Travelers had to cross Cook Strait by boat and then board a basket that was attached to the station's crane. And after that, there was an uphill walk of about 180 meters or 196 yards to the lighthouse itself. This was a pretty extreme, solitary-type position that you would accept.
Lyell, his wife, and a son also brought along a cat named Tibbles when they moved to Stephen's Island. The idea was that Tibbles would keep the mice at bay and also be a companion for this lonely outpost. They were not the island's only residents, actually, but we'll come back to that. Of course, a good mouser such as Tibbles would also probably be interested in going after small nocturnal birds as well, especially since, as Holly said earlier, they've been described as mouse-like. But that was never the intention. They did not on purpose bring a cat to kill birds.
No. And usually when you hear this story told, they really only talk about David Lyle and Tibbles, and his any family is kind of left out. But so not long after David and Tibbles and his family arrived on the island, the cat started bringing fresh kills to her human. Lyle was interested in nature, and he was an amateur ornithologist, and he had never seen a bird quite like the ones that Tibbles was killing. So he examined them, and he skinned them as he did to, you know, more fully take account of what their body was like and what these birds were.
When a ship brought supplies to the island on its regular bi-monthly schedule, Lyle sent one of his wren skins back on it, intending for it to reach a well-known ornithologist, Sir Walter Buller. It's believed that he did receive this skin sometime in July 1894. Later on, Buller would write, quote, "There is probably nothing so refreshing to the soul of a naturalist as the discovery of a new species. You will readily understand, therefore, how pleased I was at receiving the skin of a bird from Stephen Island, which was entirely distinct from anything hitherto known."
Eventually, Lyle collected 10 samples. That number is going to shift around when we get to the reality, but for the purposes of this story, 10 samples from Tibble's offering. And they were in good condition because the cat seemed to be more interested in killing the birds than she was in eating them. Feline behaviorists might also suggest that she was bringing them to Lyle as a means of offering him provisions, showing she could take care of him as well as herself. There are also theories that cats do that to try to teach us stupid humans how to find our own food. But in any case, she was not eating them, so they were in quite good condition. After he had been examining these various specimens, Buller realized that the birds Lyle had been collecting from Tibbles were a previously unidentified species of wren. So one of these, Buller sent to London to the British Ornithologist Union so it could be illustrated. And he also was preparing his research and findings so that he could publish his discovery of the Stevens Island wren in the journal Ibis.
It was believed that there had likely been 10 mating pairs of the wren on Stevens Island before Tibbles the cat got there. This is not a large number of birds, to be sure. So it would not really take very long for an enterprising cat with decent hunting skills to severely damage those numbers.
In 1895, just a year after Lyle and his cat had arrived on the island, the Christchurch Press commented on Tibbles' work. Quote, "There is very good reason to believe that the bird is no longer to be found on this island. As it is not known to exist anywhere else, it has apparently become quite extinct. This is probably a record performance in the way of extermination."
And according to legend, Tibbles wiped out the Stevens Island wren almost as soon as it was recognized as a newly discovered species.
So that's the story that you usually get told in quickie articles.
Yep. Or in like a one sentence throwaway line in the context of something completely different. It will be like, and there was even an entire species of bird killed by the lightkeeper's cat.
Yeah, but there is a lot more to this story. And before we dive into that bigger, more detailed version of what happened to the Stevens Island wren, we're going to pause and have a word from one of our sponsors.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
While the story of Tibbles and the Stevens Island Wren is a cautionary tale about the dangers of invasive species, and that is a very legitimate concern, the very simplified version that is normally shared leaves out some more complex and nuanced elements to the decline of one species due to the import of another, as well as the involvement of many more players in the narrative.
Yes, we are definitely not downplaying the threat of invasive species, but that there's a bigger story going on here. During the construction period for the lighthouse, an anonymous collector had visited the island to gather specimens. Galbraith and Brown put forth the theory in their paper that the collector, which was a pseudonym used by that person in question when publishing in the Wellington Evening Post, was in fact none other than the local natural history dealer, which was a man named Henry H. Travers.
And before Lyle and Tibbles even set foot on the island, Sir Walter Buller was aware of the number of birds to be found there, most likely due to the accounts that the collector had published in the paper, or through contact with Travers himself. Of note, however, no wren was actually mentioned in the writings of the collector. I also just love that he wrote as the collector because, of course, there's a whole Guardians of the Galaxy comedy tie-in that we could do. But he'd not mentioned the wren at all in any of these writings. And there were no mentions of a wren in the comments of Buller at a January 1893 meeting of the Wellington Philosophical Society, where he discussed some of the unique birds that could be found on Stevens Island.
Buller also suggested at that meeting that two other New Zealand islands, Resolution Island and Little Barrier Island, could be used as preservation grounds for some of the bird species that were experiencing population decline on the mainland. But it appears that no similar consideration was given to Stevens Island.
Regarding David Lyle and Tibbles, we mentioned a few moments ago that they were not the only ones who had moved onto the island. In fact, there were three lighthouse keepers and their families, as well as a teacher to see to the children's education. 17 people in all at the start of 1894 when the lighthouse became operational.
While Lyle was sending his samples to Buller, at some point Henry Travers also became aware of the unique items being relayed by Lyle through an intermediary aboard the supply ship. Travers and Buller were not unknown to each other as a dealer in natural items. Travers had done business with Buller on a number of occasions, and Travers felt as though such rare and unique specimens could be sold for more than Buller was able to pay. He convinced Lyle to sell him some of the wren skins.
Yeah, so in addition to whatever cat activities are happening, we are now seeing an uptick in human interest in these birds. And this is where yet another man enters the picture, the Honorable Walter Rothschild, who had dealt with both Travers and Buller as specimen dealers prior to this new discovery of the Stevens Island wren. And as a wealthy Englishman, Rothschild had both the means to pay handsomely for rare specimens and the connections to publish information about them before Buller could.
There actually was some realization among the British ornithologists involved in publishing the Ibis in the British Ornithologist Club Proceedings periodical, to which Rothschild's research had been presented, that there were two men describing the same find, but both went to press.
Yeah, so for clarity at this point, Travers has started selling to a very rich person in London, Rothschild. At the same time, Buller is also purchasing these samples, and they are writing up about this newly discovered species. And they both presented to both the Ibis and the British Ornithologist Club's Proceedings, which is their little periodical, their notes on their meetings. And that's a small enough group that there were a lot of crossover people going, hey, don't we have a thing from that guy Buller about this?
Didn't I read this before?
Yeah, but we're going forward with this too. So they both published, and it was a little bit of a gentleman's drama. So Rothschild named the wren Traversia leali in the Proceedings that was published in December of 1894. When Buller's paper came out in April of 1895, the bird was called Xenicus insularis. And this entire chain of events caused massive friction between the two men, each declaring that the other had not been a gentleman. You may recall from the beginning when we talked about the bird that it is called Xenicus, and then sometimes Traversia in parentheses, leali. So in the end, there was sort of a combining of the two in the scientific community.
This is like a much smaller in every sense of the word version of the Bone Wars.
Yes.
But even before Buller's paper, which was printed by Ibis, that editorial from the Christchurch Press we mentioned earlier that declared the wren likely extinct had already come out. So there was already an article saying the bird was probably extinct before the scientific paper on it.
Yeah, so there was the first printed stuff in December. In March, that article came out in the Christchurch paper saying there are no more of these birds. And then in April, Buller's paper was published saying, I have discovered a new kind of bird. It's a very complex and tightly packed timeline in terms of like discovery and when this bird was thought to have ended. So in March of 1895, Travers wrote to Rothschild a letter that suggested that he was hunting wrens himself to send to London. Quote, I have recently returned from a special trip to Stevens Island, where I went to have a good hunt for more specimens of Traversia leali, but unfortunately without success. I hunted the island over and round, and as I had three men with me who formed my boat crew and some of the residents of the island, you can imagine we made a thorough search. I did not get any specimens of the bird I went specifically for, although Mr. Lyle's boy gave me a specimen that had been found just alive by the owner of the cat that had caught the others, and this his father had put into spirit. So at that point, humans are also hunting the bird.
That claim of extinction in early 1895 may have been premature. For one, Travers seems to have used the news of the extinction to charge higher prices for the preserved bird specimens that he offered to collectors after that. So he might have been perpetuating this claim of extinction for his own financial gain.
Yeah, if you look at how his prices rated, that first one that he sent to Rothschild, I think he charged £5 for, and then he tried to charge £35 for and was eventually talked down to 12, if I'm remembering correctly. So he was definitely like, there are no more of this bird. It is a lot more expensive now. But both Travers and Buller each received additional specimens for several years after 1895. So even after he denounced personal collecting of endangered species specimens, Buller continued to seek out the Stevens Island wren for himself. And when I say that, I mean in specimen form, not live Stevens Island wrens. He also made purchases for his son to have them, as well as at least one other ornithologist. And Buller, for the record, maintained in his notes that all samples of the bird had come from David Lyle, and thus that would be from his cat. But that gets into some weird issues, as there are specimens in museums that are labeled as late as 1899, well after Lyle had actually moved on from the Stevens Island lighthouse job.
Additionally, there are completely mismatched accounts of just how many preserved wrens there are floating around. If you compare the records and letters of Travers and Buller, things do not match up at all. Travers was still selling Stevens Island wrens into the early 1900s, but it's unclear whether those were items that he had been hanging on to for several years or if they were new acquisitions. Additionally, even those records might not truly reflect the lots that Travers was selling at the time, so there's no way to verify even the existence of Travers' stock of the extinct bird, let alone its condition relative to its age.
Yeah, there's one story of a museum that discovered that they had a lot that someone had purchased from Travers, but it was largely destroyed. It had not been properly cared for, so they did not account for whether or not there was a wren in the mix there. There's a lot of not really fantastic record keeping, which leads to a lot of the nebulous aspects of this story. So the thing is, though, that collecting may have really had a significant hand in the extinction of the Stevens Island wren. But we don't actually know if Travers ever managed to catch any. The two times that he claimed he tried, the one that we read his writings about earlier, and there was one other time, he reported that he failed on both of those occasions.
And there are additional factors, too. Remember earlier when we mentioned that there were other people who moved to the island in addition to David Lyle and Tibbles? Apparently, someone else in that group of people also brought at least one other cat, or possibly Tibbles was pregnant when she arrived, because within a few years, there was a cat population on Stevens Island, not just one cat. And it's also possible that the name Tibbles was just attached to the story later. It wasn't even Lyle's cat in the first place, but just a cat that happened to be around.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's been simplified in a really fun way to tell, but it doesn't necessarily reflect the reality. And we're going to talk more about the cats on Stevens Island and what happened to all those bird bodies after we first take a little sponsor break.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Danielle Moody here, host of the Woke AF Daily podcast. We've been with iHeart's Outspoken Network for a year, and what a year it has been. Every weekday, I navigate our rapidly changing world alongside our series of fabulous expert guests. As we head deeper into 2024 and yet another life-changing election cycle, Woke AF Daily is here to keep you sane and woke. Woke not just to the latest headlines, but also to the collective power we all have. Woke to the need to build community with those around us. Woke to how to avoid burnout, and woke to the ways we can all find joy in the madness. Make Woke AF Daily with Danielle Moody your podcast destination for 2024 election news and analysis. And tune in to hear the ways I am working to stay grounded amidst it all. Listen to Woke AF Daily Season 5 on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, my name's Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of On Purpose. I just had a great conversation with Michael B. Jordan, and you can listen to it right now. Michael is known for his performances in both film and television. His breakout role was in Fruitvale Station, playing Oscar Grant, which earned him widespread praise and numerous award nominations. His portrayal of Killmonger in Marvel's Black Panther, one of my favorites, further solidified his status as one of Hollywood's leading actors, earning him widespread acclaim for his complex and compelling performance. In our conversation, Michael really opens up. You're going to love listening to it, and I can't wait for you to check it out.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. It's always the feeling when you're getting ready to, you know, people give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get. People quit.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
So right before we went to break, Tracy was saying that there was a cat population at some point on the island, and it's unclear when exactly it became more than one cat or if it had always been more than one cat. There are mentions of other cats in notes and writings made by people about those early days of the lighthouse community, but these are all anecdotal and they were written after the fact, so they're not especially reliable. As early as 1895, though, Lyell was writing notes to Buller about the available birds on the island, and he specifically references some of them being scarce due to cats, plural. He also describes those cats as having become wild, so there was already the beginning of a feral population like a year after he had arrived.
By 1897, the cat population was noted by a lighthouse keeper as being a, quote, large number. The report that description was included in also suggested that some means of destroying the cats had to be found. A few years later, in 1901, the native reptile population was also in danger and a bounty was established on the cats.
Yeah, at that point, they were kind of like, well, the birds are already gone. So we'll figure this out. And it got put off. But then
they were like,
there was a very glorious reptile population on Stevens Island. And they were like, okay, we can't let this happen again. Now we have to kill the cats, which sucks.
This is reminding me of the webcomic Camp We Don't Want You. I don't know if you've ever read that, but it is a camp about children who have been sent by their parents to this camp because they are not wanted for whatever reason. And in one of the early strips, there is what everyone thinks is going to be a food drop, but it turns out to be a box full of feral cats. And every installment of the strip after that has a cat hidden somewhere.
So in 1905, this was 4 years after the cat bounty was established, Sir Walter Buller made a written suggestion that cats should no longer ever be allowed on the island or on any other isolated islands where native species could fall victim to their prey drive. And he also included the suggestion that if mice were a concern, for example, if people were going to take care of the lighthouse and they were worried about mice, that the state should provide, at state expense, mouse traps rather than allow feline rodent management in such places.
Over the course of more than two decades, hundreds of cats were shot on Stevens Island. And in 1925, the island was declared to be free of cats.
So even though it is not really entirely fair to blame Tibbles for ending the Stevens Island wren, the role of cats in shifting the balance of wildlife populations is one which has been debated for some time. And cats most assuredly were responsible for the majority of the deaths of those birds, and they were threatening other native wildlife on the island after those wrens were gone.
According to a study published in Nature in 2013, free-ranging domestic cats in the United States were estimated to kill 1.3 to 4 billion birds. That's billion with a B. And 6.3 to 22.3 billion, also with a B, mammals annually. For the purposes of that study, domestic cats included both cats that have a home but are allowed to roam and strays, including ferals, with homeless cats responsible for most of those kills. That same study also commented that, quote, free-ranging cats on islands have caused or contributed to 33 or 14% of the modern bird, mammal, and reptile extinctions recorded by the International Union for Conservation of Nature Red List.
Humans are still trying to figure out how to manage cat populations in ways that are humane in order to curtail the unbalanced mortality in other species that can result from even well-fed but still prey-driven animals. While cats, as we discussed on an older episode, have become part of human culture, both for their excellent pest-hunting skills as well as their companionship, they are also very, very good at multiplying at a really rapid rate. So efforts to find and execute a solution still continue.
As an aside, it appears to have been Rothschild's account of the entire situation that first pinned the loss of the entire species on Tibbles, and then that was repeated for simplicity for more than 100 years.
Yeah, and Rothschild this whole time, we should point out, was in London. It wasn't like he was on the scene. He wrote this after the fact and having never actually been to the place where this was taking place. And as for what happened to all of those deceased birds that were collected on the tiny island, there are 15 wren specimens accounted for, and those have made their way into museum collections around the world. Of the samples Rothschild gathered, the Natural History Museum in London has 3. The Museum of Natural History in New York has 4. The Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia has 1. And the Museum of Comparative Zoology in Cambridge, Massachusetts has 1.
The 3 that Buller had, 1 for himself and 2 for his son, are in the Canterbury Museum, Christchurch, which has 2. And the last is in the Carnegie Museum in Pittsburgh.
There are also Stevens Island wren specimens at the Colonial Museum, now the Museum of New Zealand, Te Papa Tongarewa. I am probably mispronouncing that. I could not find a good pronunciation example, which is in Wellington, and the Otago Museum in Dunedin. And that one actually lists 2, but only 1 is clearly accounted for. So there's a little bit of fuzziness there as well.
The Stevens Island Lighthouse still exists. It was converted from oil to electric in the late 1930s and then was automated in the late 1980s. In 1989, the last lighthouse keeper left the island. It's not open to the public, and the Maritime New Zealand's Wellington office conducts operation and monitoring of the lighthouse remotely.
Yeah, if you want to go to the island, you're probably a scientist. Because there are still multiple rare species on the island, particularly what has been described by scientists as a diverse reptile community, it is now a nature reserve. For example, a reptile called the tuatara is of particular import on Stevens Island, as it is the only surviving species of its order. They are also the cutest things, in my opinion. If you see pictures of them, they just have very cute little expressive faces.
Yeah, I saw some videos of one. Apparently there was a reintroduction effort with them. And as I was looking for examples, I was looking for videos of New Zealanders saying all these words. And then I got down a rabbit hole of looking at lizard videos.
They're really cute. And it really has become, New Zealand is really making a massive effort at conservation. And in part, this whole episode is the driver of some of those efforts. Like, people realized, oh, if we are not thoughtful about how we handle particularly these small islands that are harboring things that cannot be found anywhere else and are small in number, we will then make sure those never exist on the earth again, and we don't want that. So there is a lot of care going into trying to preserve native species.
Yeah.
So that is the more complicated than just Tibbles the cat ate all the birds version of how the Stevens Island wren went extinct.
Yeah.
Although cats were responsible for a lot of it.
I sounded a lot more chipper when I said yeah than the story actually warrants.
Yeah. So only in museums now in their deceased form, unfortunately.
Yes.
Thanks so much for joining us on this Saturday. Since this episode is out of the archive, if you heard an email address or a Facebook URL or something similar over the course of the show, that could be obsolete now. Our current email address is historypodcast@iheartradio.com. You can find us all over social media at Missed in History. And you can subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.